For the argument in Crandall versus the City and County of Denver, I want to advise the council that Justice Hobbs does intend to participate. He was not able to be here this afternoon. So we're ready to hear from the petitioner, please.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice. May it please the court. Fritz Gans on behalf of the petitioners. This appeal arises from an award of cost pursuant to Colorado Revised Statute 1317-201. It's the fee shifting provision for dismissal of a tort action on motion under Rule 12B. The district court in this case awarded, Denver sought an award of $173,327.71 for fees and costs it asserted were its reasonable fees in defense of the action that was dismissed pursuant to the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act. This was an issue of timely notice under the CGIA. That case went up on appeal after petitioners prevailed at the trial court and the Court of Appeals, and this court reversed with a mandate to dismiss the action under Rule 12. Now, primary issues, the two issues that were certified and that certiorari was granted on in this case were, one, whether or not Denver could recover fees and costs for work it expended that was ultimately useful in defense of a continuing and companion action, a federal citizen suit that petitioners filed in U.S. District Court here in Colorado. The two cases were very related. They arise from the same facts and circumstances, the environmental conditions at Denver International Airport, and that there were petitioners had identified from the billing records that Denver provided in support of this request an identification of work that was ultimately useful in the continuing litigation between the parties. The second issue. The second issue that we're here to discuss today was whether or not the district court improperly shifted to petitioners the burden of differentiating from the billing records those costs and fees that are recoverable and those which are not. With respect to the first issue, whether or not recovery of fees and costs for work useful in continuing litigation can be recovered under the statute, it's consistent with the policy of similar and analogous rules, shifting fees upon dismissal of an action, that such work should not be recovered. The statute has a deterrent purpose.
Again, Scott, I just wanted to ask you two factual questions. One was, what's the timing between the RCRA case and the Denver case that was filed? And secondly, when the fees affidavits were filed by Denver, and the objection was made by the plaintiffs, what did you use to differentiate in your motion? I understand you made a legal argument, but what was your, because you came up with a specific figure, I'm just interested in what was the theory of differentiation from looking at the billing records?
Sure. With respect to the first question, the timing, the RCRA case, the Resource Conservation Recovery Act citizen suit, was filed in February of 2005. It should be noted that that does come after the filing of the state action in Denver District Court.
And which was when?
I'm sorry?
Which was when?
Which I believe was in 2003, but I may have the date.
Two years later?
Right. 2 years prior to the RCRA action. And frankly, the discovery in the state case is precisely what put the petitioners on notice of the fact that there was, in addition to their state law claims under tort theories, a similar federal action for injunctive relief under the federal environmental statutes. And this is because during the course of the discovery process and the state action that led up to the Trinity hearing, which a number of defenses were put on, in addition to the Governmental Immunity Act defense, all of that gave rise to the fact that there was this aircraft de-icing fluid out there that was degrading, and that in response to complaints of odors of mold and physical adverse health effects from mold, Denver's own personnel were saying, no, it's not mold, it's aircraft de-icing fluid, which is again why the discovery, of the cost of which they're seeking recovery of for dismissal of the state action under Rule 12, all of that discovery was useful in the federal action. As to the methodology by which petitioners parsed out work that was useful in the federal litigation subsequent to the state action, primarily it was the discovery process. That first category, if you look at page 13 of petitioner's opening brief, the chart that's identified there has essentially information gathering. That's the discovery process. All of that, including depositions taken, were used in the federal suit. For instance, petitioners were not redeposed in the federal action. Their state deposition was used. So that's the first category, and it was, again, looking at their billings, it's impossible to pull out, to say that any portion of that was related specifically to the governmental immunity issues. All of that work would have had to have been done to respond to essentially a parallel claim for injunctive relief that the petitioners brought in the federal lawsuit.
Counsel, can I just ask you a follow-up question on that very point? I guess you're saying that what you identified would have been useful, the work would have been useful in the federal action, correct? But had the federal action never occurred, I mean, is there any claim that you're making that the work wouldn't have been done? I guess I'm wondering, they're not recovering any fees that just, where the work just would apply to the federal action, correct?
That's correct. And so what we have, but again, the methodology goes back to really, what is it, what is the purpose of this statute? It's not a punitive statute. This is a compensatory statute. And the deterrent is you need to compensate the other side for the cost, the fees and costs associated with the defense of the dismissed action. And if you look at it in the context of continuing and companion litigation, this is clearly a case where the lion's share of the work that was done aided them in the defense of federal action. And to find that those costs are recoverable under sections 17201 would essentially leave petitioners in the place of funding the Denver's defense of their action in federal court.
Well, except that, I guess, just as a follow-on, they would have expended those hours, I guess, your first answer to me, they had to expend those hours in this case. They wouldn't, I mean, let's just imagine there was no federal action at all. They would have expended the same number of hours in this case that they claimed. Isn't that correct?
That may be correct, but what we're saying is they ultimately received a benefit from those hours. The time was not wasted on a case that was dismissed under Rule 12. Those efforts, mostly the discovery that led up to the Trinity hearing, that obviously resulted in the dismissal under Rule 12, all of those efforts were useful in a case that not only was properly litigated in the federal court, but went all the way through a bench trial. And again, a lot of the discovery was conducted prior to the filing of petitioner's RCRA lawsuit. Again, it was...
Are they entitled to attorney's fees now that you lost in federal court?
There was a bill of costs that was submitted in that, but again...
Including attorney's fees?
I don't believe it includes attorney's fees. I think it's a bill of costs, not for dismissal under Rule 12, but for a judgment on the merits. And so it's a different standard. And again, that if, for instance, this was a not a Rule 12 motion, but one converted to one under Rule 56, I don't think we'd be here today either. But the fact of the matter is that the deterrent purpose of the statute would be met here. It's not frustrated by a finding that if they benefited from the work that was done, albeit in defense of the dismissed action, ultimately benefited from that work in a subsequent litigation, there should be no recovery of that under the statute here. And it should be, it's worth noting that by the time this made its way up the appellate through the appellate process and the bill of costs was submitted, Denver knew that it was defending itself vigorously in federal court and was using this information. And so it's not a situation where when they submitted it, they didn't know they'd be subject to future litigation on the same facts and circumstances by the same parties. We were hotly litigating that case in federal court. And in fact, during this appellate process, we went to trial on that.
Let me follow up on something you just said. Why do you think it would be a different situation if this were 56 as opposed to 12?
Because the statute does not apply if it's under Rule 56. The statute's deterrent purpose is to deter unnecessary litigation.
It doesn't have anything to do with the level or the amount of work, just simply the statute itself.
That's correct.
Okay.
And again, it goes back to whether or not the central question is it reasonable? This is a reasonable, you know, they're entitled to their reasonable attorney's fees under the statute. And inherent in that analysis is whether or not we're serving the purpose of the statute. And
how far would you take your reasoning? In this case, you had the two lawsuits going on almost simultaneously, I guess. How far would you take your reasoning in that this information was useful for some other case? Would your reasoning apply if the city had been defending another case against a completely different set of plaintiffs?
You know, I don't think I would, but I don't think we need to get there. But for instance, I think some of the essential facts that make it the appropriate reasonableness determination in this case to exclude those costs is the fact that it is the same parties. They were essentially contemporaneous lawsuits. They do arise from exactly the same environmental conditions, and in fact, both of them have a claim for injunctive relief up to abate the same environmental conditions. And so I think the nexus between the two is very strong here. I think if you had different parties asserting that, you know, plaintiff A had already sued them, and they already did all the work to, you know, they had all the discovery in boxes, they can't come back and recover that from us simply because we sued them after the fact and lost. I don't think that's what we'd be saying here.
How do you relate that limitation to the purpose? Because you seem to be trying to say that the reason why they shouldn't be able to recover these is because it's not consistent with the purpose. However, in the example that the Chief Justice gave to you, you draw a limitation, but I don't know why you would have that limitation, and I'd like to know how that relates to the purpose.
Well, the best analogy would be a voluntary dismissal under Rule 41A. The notion that if a plaintiff voluntarily dismisses their action that and subsequently brings another action on essentially the same factual circumstances, perhaps different legal theories, et cetera, that the extent of the recovery is for any work that was rendered useless by the dismissal. In other words, defending, you know, or you know, preparing initial disclosures once again, et cetera. Here, what you have is essentially the same scenario where the only reason the federal claim was brought in U.S. District Court is obviously a jurisdictional provision of the statute, the fact that it's a federal question. It would be a very different result. I mean, for instance, if petitioners had simply amended their complaint, would we be here today? It's something they could have done, but it would have, again, derailed a process and wasted judicial resources, because at this point we've now got a Trinity hearing that's been had, and, you know, in light of the discovery, they observed that they do in fact have a RCRA claim. So I think it serves the purpose of the statute, because it goes back to what is Denver out of pocket on.
And Denver's but why doesn't it also serve the purpose of the statute in the example that the Chief Justice gave to you? That is, when it's work on an entirely different case, but still it's not rendered useless. Now you drew that limitation, and you don't have to argue that case here, obviously, but that limitation seems to me to be sort of practical, but not based, not rooted in the general argument that you're making regarding purpose.
But I also think that one is whether or not there was another continuing or companion case on file at the time, I think, is a key consideration. Obviously, if Denver is sued, and it successfully defends itself under Rule 12 on one action, and then years later is defended on essentially the same type of action, albeit by a different party, I would submit to you, number one, they're well prepared to defend that claim. But number two, that if they sought a bill of costs in the second action, they wouldn't be recovering everything from below either. So again, I think the key distinction is there is continuing, ongoing companion litigation at the same time that the bill of costs is being submitted. And so, in other words, you know that you've already received a benefit from these fees and costs. You're petitioning for recovery in a state action and benefiting from them in a parallel action. And that is what we're saying is beyond the purpose of the, you know, the deterrent purpose rather than punitive purpose of the statute.
So are you suggesting that your opponent shouldn't be paid for work that helps them in two cases, or simply that they shouldn't be double paid?
It's primarily that if there's no basis for recovery in the second action for those fees and costs, because it was just under the American rule, that's what their fees and costs were to defend that action. It's work they would have incurred anyways. They don't get recovery of that simply because along the way, other claims were deemed, you know, to be, obviously, there was a subject matter jurisdiction question, and they were dismissed under Rule 12. What we're saying is, in this case, because they benefited from them, the work was beneficial to them, that they don't recover that under this tort law statutory provision that says if you get a tort action dismissed under Rule 12, you get your reasonable fees and costs. It goes back to what is reasonable under the circumstances and whether or not it serves the policy of the statute to essentially punish a petitioner for bringing an action, not having all of its legal theories advanced because, frankly, the discovery had not been done. Those are things that came out of the discovery in the first case. And successfully litigate that case, at least through bench trial, albeit an adverse verdict, adverse ruling. But whether or not those can reasonably be applied under the deterrent statute that we have in front of us. And fundamentally, what it does is take a reasonable position and add a component of whether or not it's punitive. If awarding all of these fees and costs would be punitive, essentially, is it fair? Are you requiring petitioners to essentially indemnify them for a portion of their defense in the federal lawsuit?
So, because I understand why it's punitive, I guess, in the sense of harsh. But you continue to say that it would not have any deterrent value to require the payment of attorney's fees for things that were actually done, that they remain useful in another case. And it seems to me that, I guess I don't understand why that doesn't have deterrent value. I mean, if anything, it seems to increase the deterrent value to realize that going into this, you are going to be liable for the entire fees and aren't going to get a break for those things that remain useful elsewhere. So maybe you could help me understand why it doesn't have deterrent value.
And I may have misspoken. I think it does. It obviously increases the deterrent value. And I think it takes the statute from one which it should be compensatory in nature to one that is, in fact, punitive.
I see. Maybe I misunderstood what you were saying.
And that's precisely why I think the result that we're asking for here is a result that is consistent with the intent of the legislature. I think it's consistent with the plain language of the statute. It clearly has a reasonableness element built into it, and that the district court, at least in its legal analysis, was correct in finding that it should exclude the work that was useful ultimately in defense of the federal citizen suit.
Do you think with regard to 41, the analogy to 41, there's any difference in that there may be a policy consideration there of encouraging people to voluntarily dismiss their cases rather than pursuing them if they feel they no longer have merit?
Obviously, there's a difference. And there is an encouraging element to Rule 41A to encourage parties to dismiss for whatever reason, be it to try to seek resolution with the other party, amend their complaint to be more refined, etc. But I think there is also a similarity to be drawn between Rule 41 and Section 1317.201, which is and the facts of this case, which are there was meritorious litigation that followed that was substantially related to this case. It arose from the same facts and circumstances, same witnesses were deposed, etc. And to the extent that you basically have the same situation of a voluntary or a dismissal followed by litigation with merit, fully grounded, not frivolous, not vexatious, that was brought, albeit in a different court, but brought, litigated, and not dismissed under Rule 12, under Rule 56, on directed verdict, etc., that is a circumstance where the policy of the statute is served, and it is consistent with how Rule 41A is approached, and it has the same value. I think we're not saying they don't get anything for the value of for the cost of defending and successfully having dismissed the Rule 12 action. Obviously, if you have a dismissal under Rule 12, there are going to be costs and fees that are going to be levied against the plaintiff. That's not what we're arguing here. What we're saying is what those reasonable fees and costs are need to take into account that there was benefit to the defendant above and beyond just the Rule 12 dismissal. As to the second issue, whether or not the district court improperly shifted to petitioners the burden of identifying those costs which are recoverable and not recoverable, it goes back to the question that was raised earlier by Justice Bender as to how we came about our numbers. And frankly, petitioners were handicapped. We had the billing records that were supported. We're in a position where we don't challenge the billable rate. We don't challenge the number of hours for any given task. The question is, was that task one that served their defense to the federal lawsuit? And so when we did that, as the district court noted, we're somewhat handicapped. Consistent with other fee-shifting analyses that have been done by courts, an apportionment based on a rough percentage can be done. We provided ours in response to their bill of costs and got nothing back in return in terms of other than we get 100%. And it turns on a legal question, but it really comes back to whether or not we had a burden to ask for a hearing on this, present evidence. And again, I question what evidence we could present other than the same billing records they submitted to us.
Answer your question. I'm a little confused by that second question, just generally, because it seemed to me that the Court of Appeals didn't decide that issue because they said that the city's entitled to all reasonable fees, which was everything. So how do we get, how is it that the Court of Appeals actually shifted the burden in this case?
The Court of Appeals did not, but the district court, we're arguing, did. In other words,
Is that correct?
I'm sorry?
The cert question is incorrect?
No, I think the cert question is, if it references the Court of Appeals, then yes, it is correct. But it should reference the district court. The Court of Appeals did not reach that question because they obviously found that in its reasonable analysis, the consideration of whether or not the work was useful in future litigation was not a proper consideration, and that the district court's reduction of the fee request by $35,000 roughly was inappropriate and had remanded back for that amount to be added back to the judgment. We appealed from that decision, again arguing that we provided our apportionment. There was no competing apportionment of work useful in the RCRA litigation and that which was not, and so ours should stand. Again, what factual evidentiary support we could generate for that other than their own billing records, which is summarized in that chart that we prepared, I'm at a loss as to what that would be. And frankly, that's exactly why the burden to demonstrate the reasonableness, and certainly under the legal standard that if subsequent work that's beneficial in companion litigation is not recoverable under this statute, then certainly that burden falls on Denver.
Counsel, can I just follow up on that then? In your methodology, I guess I'm still, you just basically looked at the records and kind of said, oh, this general description seems like it's something that can be applicable to the federal case. I mean, is that kind of the methodology you used?
Where we could identify, for instance, the information fact gathering process, the discovery process, that is overlapping almost entirely with the federal litigation, and that was our position, is you don't get that back here. In other circumstances, there were entries in their billing records that would indicate that it was work that was useful in the future litigation and that those were added in, but ultimately a lot of them were not. For instance, the paralegal time associated with a lot of the tasks that the attorneys were working on, there is no way for us, based on the information they provided from their billing records, to differentiate. And so we proposed an 80% reduction in those circumstances to account for that. There was no competing apportionment. They simply came back and said, no, we're entitled to all of it. And so, but that's a factual determination that the trial court should be, obviously be prepared to make, and that's one that would be reviewable on an abuse of discretion standard.
So did the trial court make any adjustments, though, on your numbers?
Now, the trial court...
Just accepted?
The trial court accepted the first category, that's the $35,543 figure, and did not, there are two other categories that were on that chart that identify not only work that was useful in supporting unsuccessful defenses, which is not an issue that's before this court, but work that was useful in the continuing RCRA litigation. And so while the district court accepted ours, and on our motion for for post-trial relief, we essentially, the district court came back and said, while some of the work may have been useful in the RCRA litigation, not all of that which was useful in the RCRA litigation would be recovered under the statute, that some of it would be recovered, in this case, on dismissal under Rule 12.
Well, they asked for $173,000, and you thought that they only should get $11,000.
That's correct.
I mean, that's a hell of a discount.
And a lot of that, again, some of that was because this case did go all the way up to, petitioners prevailed all the way before until this court reversed both the trial court and the Court of Appeals. So there was a lengthy process involved here, and along the way, defenses were dropped. But again, and that includes what we're talking about here is a lion's share of the work that was related to the RCRA case. With that, if there aren't any more questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Andrew Rangel. I'm here on behalf of the respondent, City and County of Denver. With me is Andrew Carafelli at council table. I wanted to clear up a couple of factual issues at the beginning and then proceed into my argument. As a factual matter, in response to Justice Bender's question, the complaint was filed July 1st, 2003. The federal complaint was filed February 7th, 2005. The Trinity hearing occurred in the summer of 2004, and the original district court order on the Trinity decision was September 9th, 2004. So what happened was Denver successfully convinced the trial court to stay pursuant to the Governmental Immunity Act on the interlocutory appeal, and at that point the RCRA lawsuit was filed. So that's sort of the interaction between those two things. The other sort of factual issues that I wanted to clear up, I think, based on the discussion that I heard with counsel for the petitioners are two. One, I think it's important for the court to recognize that our law firm had separate client matter numbers for the two different lawsuits. So everything that was specifically related to the RCRA lawsuit is not in any form part of the fees that were requested in this lawsuit. There is a total separation between those two things.
Oh, but you did use depositions and stuff like that that you took in state court?
The depositions were used for purposes of impeachment during the federal trial. That's it.
What about the investigator? I mean, you must have used some of the investigator.
Well, I think there's the possibility of overlap, but I think what the court should recognize is that the discovery that was conducted in state court is limited. It was related to the notice issue under the CGIA, and it was also related to the issue of the specificity of the notice. The issue of specificity of notice wasn't before this court previously, but it was before the Court of Appeals, and there were two depositions were taken in the trial court before the Trinity hearing. If the court compares the order from the district court, the order from the Court of Appeals, and the order of this court versus the Tenth Circuit's order and the district court's order in the RCRA case, it's very clear that the issues factually are very different. The issue in the RCRA case has to do with the nature of the chemicals and what they are and where are they and where are they coming from and whether they pose an imminent danger under the standard under RCRA. The issues in the trial court from a factual perspective in the Trinity hearing and the discovery that was ordered have to do with notice, scope, and particularity of notice. And
Mr. Ringel, did you do, before the RCRA case was filed, did you do internal discovery to determine the toxic substances and all that?
Oh, sure, we did investigation.
So that was useful, of course, in the RCRA subsequent litigation, right?
The possibility exists that it was useful, but it's
possibility?
Well,
you're being sued in tort, and you had a potentially dangerous situation, as I recall the facts of these that were claimed, right?
That's correct.
So I'm quite sure that you did a lot of internal investigation.
There was investigation done both internally with officials at the city.
Was that sought? Did you seek?
No, that wasn't sought, and I think you can examine the time records. What we tried to do was we collected documents about complaints about odors, which is how this started. And, you know, what the other thing I think is important to point out factually is the $173,000 sounds like a lot of money, and it is a lot of money. We did not request $103,000 that was also billed in the state case, that we and our expert Andrew Nathan exercised billing judgment and never submitted as a request for the trial court. And some of the things that Justice Bender, you're referencing, were excluded from the fee petition. And you know, all of the fees that were requested, all the billing records are contained in the record before this court. You can satisfy yourselves about, you know, what was requested and what wasn't. But you know, it was our intent to focus on the CGIA notice issues and sort of basic investigation stuff. The interesting thing to me is that the discovery occurred on the CGIA issue over Denver's objection. We thought it was something that could be decided on the briefs and didn't need discovery. Plaintiffs sought the discovery on CGIA issues. The district court allowed it. We went into the discovery, and then we did the discovery that was requested by the plaintiffs as part of the precursor to the Trinity. The other thing that I think is important to understand is that, you know, setting aside those factual issues, what strikes me about this analysis is there's no nexus to either the statutory language, the purposes of the statute, or any precedent that supports the notion that you should somehow have an exception in the statute that basically says you get your reasonable attorney's fees unless they might be useful in companion or other litigation.
Maybe I don't want to misstate Mr. Gann's argument, but it seems to me what he's saying is that the useful billing for the RCRA case exceeds the purpose of the statute. So that it becomes punitive and not compensatory, and this, in short, is unreasonable in terms of the statute. That's his argument. So what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that is a couple things. One, that would be creating a exception to the General Assembly statute, which is cast in mandatory terms that doesn't exist. I understand that.
It says reasonable. So.
It does say reasonable, but you know, this court's analysis under its own rule, 41A2, is different, given that that's discretionary and given that that's a rule of practice. And the what occurred to me when I was looking at this in preparing for oral argument is when a trial court would be required to do a Rule 41A analysis about whether this is useful potentially in another litigation or not, the trial court has all of the facts and has had the case litigated in front of it and can make a determination based on what was before the trial court on that kind of nuanced thing. What the rule that the plaintiffs and the petitioners would want in this case essentially requires a trial court to do that about another court with imperfect information. They don't have the whole docket in front of them. They haven't managed the discovery. They haven't done all those things that would inform a trial court about how to do this kind of thing. I think that's the kind of practical difference between those two statutes. The other sort of practical difference is the colloquy that Chief Justice Mularkey and Justice Martinez had with Mr. Gans. How far out do you make this rule go? If it has an exception to this statute, there has to be a limit to the exception. And I think if you sort of spin out the possibilities of how that would work, it demonstrates why there shouldn't be an exception at all. For example, if there was a case involving a failed escalator at Denver International Airport, to take an example, and someone was injured because the escalator failed, Would it be reasonable for when an escalator fails, or the same escalator or a different escalator 5 years later, for that second plaintiff who has their lawsuit dismissed on a 12B governmental immunity notice to get the benefit and be able to say, well, wait a minute, you had this earlier case 5 years from before related to this same escalator. Obviously, you did investigation, obviously did preparation prior to the Trinity hearing in that case. You shouldn't get some of the fees in that case. I mean, you know, it strikes me that the petitioner's argument is to create an exception that doesn't have a reasonable boundary and is not really grounded in the statute. I also don't think it is grounded in the deterrent purpose of the statute, and I also respectfully disagree that it's punitive. It would only be punitive if Denver was seeking more than the actual fees that it requested, and it actually expended in the litigation itself. That's not the case here. Denver expended approximately $275,000 in this litigation and is requesting $173,000, thereby exercising a pretty good billing judgment there. And it's not like we're trying to get an additor or something like that. It's not like Denver is trying to argue under sort of prevailing party methodology that our success was so great that we should get, you know, a benefit of the success. You know, none of those kind of arguments are being made, making me believe that this is a compensatory request and not a punitive request. This court has not, as far as I have been able to locate, interpreted this statute in terms of its purposes. The Court of Appeals in the Employers Insurance of Wausau case interpreted it and concluded that in enacting this statute, the General Assembly sought to discourage and deter the institution or maintenance of unnecessary litigation concerning tort claims. I think that that's an important sort of focus, that deterrent focus. There was nothing that required the plaintiffs in this case to frame their claims for relief in the manner that they did, requesting the damages that they did. If this was really about solving what they perceived to be a problem with mold or de-icing fluid or whatever at Denver International Airport, they could have made this from the get-go in state court a claim for injunctive relief. Had they done solely that, the Governmental Immunity Act doesn't apply, and they would have had the ability to proceed and try to seek injunctive relief. What the statute tries to make as a stop and think, and what I believe has more importance in the governmental immunity context, is before you seek tort damages and file a tort claim, you need to be sure that you have the ability to survive a 12B motion. And Denver consistently made 12B arguments and was ultimately successful on the 12B notice of claim argument before this court. And given the deterrent purpose of the statute and given the plain language of the statute, it seems to me that it's an appropriate result to have Denver compensated for the reasonable attorney's fees that it expended in the defense after it and its expert exercised the billing judgment that occurred in this case. Before I move on to the second question,
I won't let you move on.
Okay.
So can you tell me, though, why should we not follow the rule in the voluntary dismissal cases? Why is that, I guess, in your opinion, not applicable here?
A couple reasons. One, the nature of the two statutes, I think the purposes of them are different. The purpose of the voluntary dismissal statute is to allow a defendant to be compensated for unuseful for expenses that are made useless because of a voluntary dismissal. The purpose of this, of 1317-201, is the deterrent purpose. The difference in the two statutes' operations, I think, is important, or the rule in the statute, because you have in the context of 41A2, a discretionary decision by a trial court who can look, as I said before, at what was before it. In this case, the argument is not being made that the expenses weren't reasonable and that they weren't necessary for this litigation at the time that they were expended. The argument is being made that a subsequent event, namely the filing of the RCRA lawsuit, made those expenses also potentially useful for the RCRA lawsuit, and therefore it's not reasonable to compensate Denver for them in this case. Those are, to me, comparing apples and oranges.
Well, what about, I guess the argument, I mean, you haven't addressed directly and head on that you are receiving a benefit. You have a benefit. You're being benefited from this. Basically, I mean, I think that's the argument, that somehow you're able to take this work and use it in something in some other context.
Let me add to that. Plus, get attorney's fees when you couldn't get them in federal court.
Well, they could have been sought in federal court. RCRA has a prevailing party fee statute.
I asked the question, but you didn't.
It wasn't asked for because under federal law, as the court may know, a case called Christianberg, the federal courts have said that the prevailing party fee statutes tend to mean that for a defendant to prevail, it needs to be frivolous and groundless or vexatious, as opposed to a simple prevailing party.
Oh, so it wasn't a frivolous and groundless suit. So
not if it goes to trial in front of a federal judge.
You're getting fees you couldn't get in the other court.
Well, the other thing I think that's important to understand, just to respond to your question, Justice Bender, is many multiples of what the requested fees in this case were expended in the federal RCRA case. The federal RCRA case was an enormous project with lots of experts, lots of testimony, lots of stuff that went on in that case, very different from the relatively narrow notice of claim and CGIA issues that were here. I would, to sort of argue what you were asking me to argue, Justice Ide, it is our position that there has been no demonstration by the plaintiff that anything that we requested as attorney's fees as compensable under 1317-201 were in fact useful in the RCRA lawsuit. There's been the legal argument that they were useful, but there's never been any evidence that they were useful. I think that the evidence could have been, petitioners could have hired an expert to review our billing records, or they could have undertaken the review themselves and made specific factual understandings of this is how this is useful, this is why this is useful, this is why you shouldn't have been compensated for it. But if you look at the totals, and it would take a detailed analysis to go through the bills and look at the different categories that were submitted to the district court, what their argument is essentially that everything related to the Trinity hearing might be useful for the RCRA lawsuit, including actually being in court at the Trinity hearing itself. And that doesn't make any sense, because that clearly can't be useful in federal court. You can't be, you know, the fact that you're arguing in front of a state district court judge that notice of claim issues are important or providing evidence about that, that has nothing to do with the issues that were litigated in RCRA and in the district court and at the 10th Circuit. It's totally different. Let me move on to the burden of proof issue, which is kind of related to what I was just talking about. It's our position that what essentially Denver did is establish the lodestar by the evidence that we presented from Mr. Nathan and from the lawyers who represented Denver, and then it was incumbent on the petitioners to come back and challenge the lodestar. And how they chose to challenge it, as Mr. Gantz admitted when he was talking to you previously this afternoon, was not on the reasonableness of the hourly rate, was not on the reasonableness of the hours expended. It was on the legal argument that they should have been related to this, that they were potentially useful for the RCRA context. If the court rejects that legal argument, there doesn't seem to be any basis for ruling in the plaintiff's favor, as the Court of Appeals recognized. But it is our position that even if the court accepts the legal argument that there is some basis under 1317-201 to reduce for collateral litigation, they haven't met their evidentiary burden, which we think is theirs. There wasn't a flip in the evidentiary burden by the trial court here. What the trial court did was essentially accept with no evidence the representation that this is the amount of fees that could be useful. What it doesn't make any logical sense to say a defendant or any party getting attorney's fees has to do more than present the fees request, present expert testimony that these are reasonable or necessary, present testimony in the form of an affidavit from lawyers who litigated it, the case, that these fees are reasonable and necessary. If that's going to be challenged, again, back to the Lodestar methodology and reduced, it's up to the petitioners to come forward with evidence to do that. They didn't do that. What Judge Stern did in this case is essentially kind of do an eyeball and decide, what do I think is reasonable, what do I think is not reasonable, and, you know, maybe that's appropriate under the abuse of discretion standard that he has to do that, but there's no basis for this court to do anything beyond what Judge Stern did, even if the court was inclined to create the exception that the petitioners are seeking here. It's our position, to sort of summarize, the statute doesn't have the kind of exception to its mandatory language that exists here. The policies of the statute don't support this kind of analysis because it would engender more litigation as opposed to deter litigation. And none of the cases that are relied upon by the plaintiff support, by a reasonable analogy, anything that has to do with 1317-201. And as a result, we think the Court of Appeals was correct and that this court should affirm, unless there are further questions. Thank you.
Just a couple points in rebuttal. And the first, and I think it's an important point, is it was touched on during respondent's argument, and that the subsequent companion litigation that we're talking about here was not the type of vexatious, groundless, meritless lawsuit that the statute was intended to deter. This is focused purely on the tort claims that were brought in state court, and it was suggested that the petitioners had the choice to simply bring an injunctive relief action in state court and forego their tort claims if that's truly what they were looking for. It misses the mark, though, because an injunctive relief action was brought in the state action, and that the companion case did go to trial, and they did benefit from work that was done early on in the state action, whether it was in response to plaintiff's discovery, plaintiff's investigation of the Government Immunity Act notice issues or not.
I don't think I followed that. The plaintiffs did bring an injunctive action?
Included in their request for damages and request for relief on the tort claims was an injunctive relief component to abate the conditions.
And what happened with that?
That was dismissed as well. And again, we actually made the argument that, in fact, when this court found that there was not timely notice under the Governmental Immunity Act, that we argued that that did not apply to the injunctive relief claims. And they took the exact opposite position. And so all claims were, in fact, dismissed on under the CGIA. And so, again, I don't think that the purpose of the statute is met here by, you know, putting petitioners in position to essentially fund the defense of a an action that is not the kind that the statute was intended to avoid. And again, petitioners are not saying that they're not responsible for the costs associated with a dismissal under Rule 12, and we're not asking for an exception to the statute. We're saying embedded in the statute, part of the statute's reasonableness analysis must be whether or not there was benefit to the defendant in subsequent and at the time contemporaneous litigation. If there's nothing further, that's all I have. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I thank both counsel for your arguments. Case